We have reached a verdict already. We all just kind of looked at each other and nodded. We find the defendant guilty of charges.
Weight 105?
Yeah,
in your bra.
Your Honor, I object.
You would.
Bastard!
Hey! Quiet!
Whether it's race judicata or stare decisis, there is no basis for imposing some draconian policy with regard to bail, nunc pro tunc.
Your Honor, the defense is now just making up words.
We came into your trial. Oh, look how cute. There's like a judge and everything. And jury people.
Vote for Al!
Ladies.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 211. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is... Well, I think it's Andrew Torres. Hello, stranger.
I've bravely roused myself out of bed. I'm on like a metric ton of cold medicine, and the show must go on, right? Nor snow, nor wind, nor rain. However, the post office goes. Let's get it to it.
Yeah, if we can't be better than the post office, then what are we doing here? No, that's awesome. You're powering through. It is the one downside of this line of work, I realized, when we don't have any like sick hour credits that we can just like tell our audience, hey, we're just taking a little sick time here. We can do a fake call to our audience. I can't work today. No, we can't do that. But we are here to talk about that NHL trade. Here we go. No. Oh, sorry. All right. Different show. I'm still excited about that, but no, we've got to talk about a lot of stuff. We're going to briefly address, we got sent by a lot of people, the news story about the defense distributed person, who was charged with sexual assault of a minor. A little update to that story. And also we're going to talk about Manafort. Interesting Manafort news came, of course, right after we record, as always, well-timed. Last week, so we'll do some updates on that. And actually, there's some interesting issues going on. Andrew thinks that maybe the media is getting some stuff wrong on that story. So I always love that. Those are my favorite kind of Andrew segments. And then finally, we are going to talk about Kavanaugh. So that's our agenda. Let's get to it.
As Charlton Heston famously said, "From my cold dead hand, you sons of bitches, this far and no further with your damn dictatorship."
Did you know that hammers kill more than guns?
Oh yeah, I'm a gun enthusiast.
Yeah. So let's really, really quickly. About 9,000 people sent us the message that Cody Wilson is apparently on the run. That's the founder of Defense Distributed and person we have identified as a crazy person, behind the release of the 3D printed guns to prevent gun control from ever being effective ever again. Apparently he got onto a website and, had sex with a minor, and that's super icky and it's really terrible. We already knew he was a terrible guy for other reasons. There's really nothing else we can cover on that story other than, you know, he seems to be terrible for multiple reasons. But
assault for that? Is that how that works?
Yeah, and the reason I suspect has to do with how the state statute would determine statutory rape, right? In other words, it is easier to prove assault, typically speaking, than it is to prove in some states.
But maybe I misunderstood. I thought you said he got online and did, this was a...
Oh, no, no, no. Oh, no. Oh. I'm sorry. He got online to a website that facilitates...
I think there's this little mini generational difference between you and I interpreted that a different way. my fault. Okay. Sorry.
No, this is, I am not going to give out, you can find this really easily. I am not going to give out the web address of the site that he patronized, but no, it's like the rent boy of underage girls, apparently. So I didn't need that in my life, and neither do our listeners. So we got it. Story's icky. He's appears to be a creep in addition to a crazy person. But you know, it's not an OA story. So
you're telling me a guy who wants to put out plans so that every man, woman, and child in this country could print their own guns is not just a normal, everyday, cool dude? I won't believe it. I won't hear it. But okay, so that's it for that. Just a brief kind of addressing that story. Yeah, it's not a major story for us. But that guy's a creep. We already knew it. You know, the authorities are handling it. All right, let's get to our main segments.
I'm asking you if you know the difference between right and wrong.
I discovered at a very early age that if I talk long enough, I could make anything right or wrong. So either I'm God or truth is relative. And in either case, booyah.
Oh, interesting. It's just the average person has a much harder time saying booyah to moral relativism.
So I've got Andrew was wrong in my notes here. What were you wrong about?
Well, I believe that my express prediction was that Paul Manafort would sign a plea deal sometime over the weekend. In fact, he signed that plea deal, I think, contemporaneously with us releasing our show.
We can't trust you for anything, Andrew.
It's been a week, and it's surprising to me that a lot of the media still seems to be getting many of the details of the Manafort plea agreement wrong. So I'm going to link the agreement in the show notes. It's, you know, it's 12, 13 pages, not super long. You can read it. It's pretty straightforward, although it's funny how certain things are hidden in the text, right? Like, so the much discussed, Rachel Maddow did a segment on the agreement in cooperation that requires Paul Manafort to participate in undercover operations, which has everybody scratching their heads. That was buried as like the second dependent clause in a general requirement that he cooperate with the investigation. We'll talk about the cooperation requirements. I don't have any idea. I the most plausible thing I have heard with respect to the undercover cooperation is that Manafort
walks in the Oval Office with like a big like jacket on and stuff. Hey, Mr. Trump, they let me out. Anyway, I got the Russians on the line, and what do you think we should tell them? Like talking into his jacket.
Can you speak up and can you frame it as I would like money in exchange for, you know, goods and right? No, I mean, it is literally on that level of implausibility to imagine that Paul
Tell you
Manafort
what, though, you could hide a lot of microphones in an ostrich jacket or whatever. That's the one benefit of needing Manafort to go undercover is you got lots of options. You could put a whole like a lion's head on his jacket or something. Just... It would work.
So I'm gonna link a Talking Points memo article just because it's typical and it shows some of the things that the press has gotten wrong and I'm gonna pick apart a few of those things. So the biggest thing, this has been everywhere. This deal is being described as having a 10-year cap, and that's not correct. The reason I totally understand how people get there, right? They get there because the opening paragraph says he is pleading guilty to two counts, each of which were brought under 18 USC 371. That is conspiracy. And those counts have a 5-year statutory maximum, right? So you go, oh, all right, 5 years times 2 = 10. But count one alleges 4 separate violations of 18, actually, sorry, count one alleges 5 separate violations of 18 USC 371, and the cap says each violation carries the 5-year maximum, right? So in that first count, Manafort is pleading guilty to money laundering, tax fraud, FBA, the financial reports, violations of the Foreign Agents Registration Act, and lying to the DOJ in connection with Mueller's investigation. That's all in count one. And the way I read 18 USC 371, that's 5 years max for each of those. Count two, and I think it's important to note that the government wasn't willing to give on this one, is the conspiracy to engage in obstructing justice for witness tampering. That was his, I don't know what it was, Snapchat messages or right. WhatsApp or whatever, where he's like, you know, hey girl, it's cool. Like,
he said a few of the doughy eyed ear images to somebody. Yeah. That's how he, I mean, it would be a smart way to, you know, do some witness tampering, because A, you'd look really cute. And then B, the pictures disappear after, you know, a minute or whatever it is. I'm not a huge Snapchat guy, but it's not that far fetched.
There you go. So what that means is that the sentencing guideline calculation is set forth in the agreement, and the government goes through it and their calculation. Again, defense counsel can reserve the right to come up with a different computation, because, as you know, we've gone through the sentencing guidelines and there is some wiggle room, right? Is some of the aggravating factors are monetary, right? And so there's no wiggle room with respect to, you know, it's over $25 million. That means plus, you know, X additional levels. But some of them, you know, did you obstruct justice in the process, right? Like, things like that. There may be wiggle room. There may be some disagreement. The government's estimation is that that gets you to offense level 37. And if you go back to the chart, offense level 37 is 210 to 262 months, which is way more than 10 years, right? Mm. That's on the order of 20 years in prison. So I think we're going to see the significance of this when we talk to the when we talk about the cooperation section. But everybody's calling this a 10-year max, and I don't see it that way. I'm on a ton of cough, you know, and cold medicine, so maybe I'm misreading the statute, but it seems pretty straightforward to me.
I'm sorry.
And otherwise, there's no reason. Go ahead.
What is a 10-year thing? So are people saying that he's pleading for a deal that means he'll serve a maximum of 10 years? Or, because it sounded like at first you said like a 10-year expiration or a 10-year limit or something. But you're saying
so
he could cut a deal and still serve like a lot more?
Yes, he could serve under this present deal. He could serve 210 to 262 or more months in prison, up to 20 years in prison under the deal that he signed.
Do you think he would even do that? I thought the whole reason he was doing a deal is because, you know, he's a little long in the tooth. And he doesn't want to spend the last 20 years of his life in prison.
That's exactly right. And here's why I think he would do that. In the cooperation agreement, if you're Paul Manafort, right, you're in your 60s and you don't exactly look like, right? Like I've had friends who are in their 60s who run triathlons, right? Like, yeah. Paul Manafort does not run a triathlon.
I play hockey with some people, a couple dudes in their 60s, and they're really good. There's only a couple.
Oh, man. I shared a secretary, and I had the office next to a huge rainmaking partner at Covington and Burling. His name was Peter Nichols. He left and he went on to DC council and, you know, corporate council and some other things. He was in his late 60s when I was in my early 20s, and he was definitely more fit than me in every way you could possibly imagine. He did triathlons. Anyway, so that's not Paul Manafort. Paul Manafort, I would not bet, has, you know, 20 more years of life left on this planet. And so what you need to get, if you are Paul Manafort, like, we went through this in Tuesday's episode. We, you know, talked about all of the various criteria, right? Like, you might just plead guilty because you're in a court where, you know, there's not much hope that you're going to be able to persuade the jury to vote not guilty anyway. And this takes some of the counts off the table. But this is a lot, right? Like, this is a significant offense for a significant period of time. So what you need is you need the government to sponsor a 5K1.1 motion. That is a motion for a downward departure. And in the sentencing guideline, and the reason you need that is because you're at offense level 37, right? So if you get, you know, all right, I acknowledged responsibility, so I get one level off. But like, quibbling about a level here and there is not going to help you when you're in your 60s and you're facing 20 plus years in jail, right? You need what 5K1.1 says, which is that upon motion of the government stating that the defendant has provided substantial assistance in the investigation or prosecution of another person who has committed an offense, the court may depart from the guidelines. So in other words, they may completely go off the matrix, and the appropriate reduction shall be determined by the court for the reasons stated that may include but are not limited to, and then there's a whole bunch of stuff, right? Like the court's evaluation of the significance and usefulness of the assistance, the truthfulness, completeness, and reliability of the information or testimony provided, all of that. So if you are looking to read into this agreement that Manafort is cooperating, this is, in my view, and again, the agreement, we're going to talk about the specific requirements. It requires him to be truthful and to cooperate and to turn over documents and all that good stuff. But he has a unique incentive now, facing 262 months in prison, to convince the government to file a 5K1.1 downward departure motion. And Mueller clearly doesn't like the guy, and rightly so, right? Like, I mean, he's
I'm just so confused about this. I mean, I really didn't think a deal was going to happen, because I don't know what more. I mean, there's not that many people higher up, and well, okay, we can get to that. Sorry to interrupt. I do want to hear why you think he's doing this eventually when you're ready.
We can absolutely go there, right? Like, this is, and again, you have to read the tea leaves, but I would ask you, why do we think Paul Manafort would agree to a deal that gives him very little leverage, right? That is throwing yourself on the mercy of a prosecutor who doesn't like you, right? who really, really wants you to serve criminal time. And you saw, I mean, I should add, it is common practice, right? It is to the court's discretion to figure out how to depart from the sentencing guidelines on a 5K1.1 motion. The court almost always accepts the recommendation of the prosecutor, right? So in other words, what you want to say there is, hey, look, I will cooperate in this particular way in exchange for you making this recommendation on sentencing. And that recommendation on the 5K1.1 motion is something the court will almost always, I mean, I can't recall ever seeing a situation where the prosecutor said, yeah, give this defendant a downward departure to, you know, 6 months or a year or whatever, and the court's like, no, we're not going to do that. He's got to serve 3 or 5 or 10 or whatever. So he is 100% at Mueller's mercy, and the only, again, you know, we're speculating, but the only thing I can come up with for that is that he definitely has something that Mueller wants.
Yeah. Well, okay. So I don't want to derail you or anything, but I read the Woodward book, and A, yes, man, it seems as though Mueller really doesn't like these people based on that work, the work of Bob Woodward. It's pretty funny, actually. Every time there's any description of a conversation with Mueller, Mueller just doesn't talk, and he just like lets the other guy do all the talking, then goes, okay. And then like, but anyway, but I also, it strikes me, I've read a lot of Trump books, you know, about, you know, the election and all this time. And I just don't think Trump is the kind of guy who you're going to get on any of this. So if the feeling is like, well, who could he be implicating? It could only be Donald Trump. He doesn't email. He's too stupid to coordinate anything like that. Like, the best you could get him on would be one of his dumb sons brought him something, you know, like, hey, the Russians want to do this. And he might have said like, oh, sure. You know, like that would be, but he's not a go-getter, you know, like it takes some mental acuity to do some of this, like, more impressive crime of coordinating with Russians and stuff. And I just don't believe he could do that unless there's something I'm missing. What potentially, you don't have to even speculate on what it is, but just like, what could it be that would, in your opinion, make Mueller want to do this deal? Could it be Donald Jr. maybe, or somebody like that?
So I'm going to answer that a little bit sideways, right? Which is to say, one of the things that we've seen again and again from Republicans, right, from Richard Burr in the Senate Intelligence Committee report, is a genuine concern about a cyber Cold War between the United States and Russia, right? A genuine concern that, as we know, and you know, and Mueller has done a significant amount of work indicting Russian nationals and firms that were engaged in hacking the U.S. election. And I find it not implausible that Mueller's motivation may not be get Trump or any one person, but maybe to say, hey, look, this is a serious issue, and this is how I'm going to connect up all the dots. And what you do with Trump, I don't care, right? Yeah. But I want to show that this is not just like, you know, I, again, 35% of the country still believes or shuts their eyes at, you know, Trump going, well, you know, WikiLeaks could just be some guy in the, you know, in his basement. Right. Like, we know, we have incontrovertible proof that Guccifer 2.0 was a Russian intelligence operative. Right. We know that Mueller is connecting up those dots. And that's something that I see Republicans really, really caring about. So that's my kind of off the cuff.
You had me until the last part. Republicans aren't going to care. But no, that's a very good answer. I hadn't thought about that. Like, maybe, you know, Mueller is not thinking like me. He's thinking like somebody who has uncovered a pretty serious conspiracy and threat to our country. And maybe he's more focused on learning more about the other side of it, not even necessarily the American side of it, but more about the Russian side of it. That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that. Okay. Good answer.
Okay. So, page 6 describes what Manafort has to do. These are his cooperation obligations, and there are a bunch, but A, B, and C are the important ones. He must attend all meetings. He must provide full and truthful information regarding all criminal activities. That's part A. Part B is he must turn over all documents relevant to the investigation. And then the second clause is what has that participating in undercover activities. And then C, he agrees to testify. The important thing here is it is at the sole discretion of Mueller, and all of these clauses are phrased in terms of the entire investigation. Anything that is relevant, and relevance in the law, we've talked about this, has an expansively broad definition. So when you see folks saying, well, you know, like Rudy Giuliani saying, well, this doesn't, you know, directly have anything to do with Donald Trump or the 2016 campaign, I guess that's technically correct for the scope of that to which Paul Manafort is allocuting. By the way, he has not yet allocated and pled guilty, as far as I can tell. I looked for the text of that. Hmm. We're going to continue to look for it. The time, the clock is ticking. He's probably engaged in substantive discussions back and forth, because it can void the agreement if he doesn't allocute properly. And so his lawyers will be sending drafts back and forth to Mueller's team. Unlike Michael Cohen, who said, just draft whatever you want me to say and I'll say it. So, you know, if you want to think about the other side, right, that is a difference between somebody who's flipped 100% lying on their back, you know, all four limbs up in the air in the dog pose of complete submissiveness, versus Manafort, who still is presumably in negotiations over how explicitly to phrase his allocution. That allocution will not mention Donald Trump. And it does not have to, because the cooperation agreement obligates him to give all sorts of information regarding Donald Trump. The deal also takes off the table the 10 counts upon which the Eastern District of Virginia reached a hung jury. I haven't seen anybody else report that, you know, maybe. But we talked about, could he be retried in the Eastern District of Virginia? And he certainly could have been. And I find it not implausible that he would have been, except for now, obviously. Not.
So the important thing for me, though, is if what he has is a crock of S and it doesn't really help anybody, it's not as though he just gets off. It's under Mueller's discretion, right? So he's not getting away.
That's exactly right. Okay. Yeah. So this is why it puts all of the power in Mueller's hands, right? Because if Manafort does not render substantial cooperation and assistance, he's going to spend the rest of his life in prison. If he does, the government may sponsor a 5K1.1 motion, and we're going to have to pay attention. But that, to me, is the biggest dynamic that's at stake. And I should add parenthetically, even if it were 10 years, that dynamic would still be in play, right? Even if for whatever reason there is an interpretation. I researched 18 U.S.C. 371 because I read it as each violation, and there are five violations charged in count one. I could not find a case that says, you know, when it's multiple violations in a single count, they're all governed by the 5 years. It's possible I missed one. So, you know, that's I hold out that possibility. I am sure our listeners will tell us if I'm wrong. I don't think I am. And I don't think it shortens the disparity. Right. But I don't think it changes the underlying calculus. If I am. One more thing before we get to the listener question. The day we dropped our Thursday show, September 13th, a week ago, The Atlantic released a story showing that Donald Trump and Paul Manafort had a joint defense agreement. This is a pretty common thing to do, where what you do is a lawyer cannot represent two people whose interests are potentially adverse in a trial, right? And particularly in a criminal trial, right? So the clearest example is if I were a criminal defense attorney and three kids were all charged with breaking and entering into, a 7-Eleven, I couldn't represent all three of them, right? Because part of the strategy of defending each individual defendant is to point the finger at the other two guys. And if I'm trying to get all three of them off, I'm not going to be able to present my best defense, right? But I am very likely to enter into a joint defense agreement with counsel for the other two defendants that allows the lawyers to trade documents back and forth. Because we do have, right, we have a potential conflict of interest that means we all have to have separate lawyers, but we obviously have a lot in common too, right? Like we have tremendous areas of overlap. If we show that, you know, nobody broke into the store, then all three get to go free and we're all happy, right? I've obviously negotiated and been a part of these in the civil context, but it's easier to understand in the criminal context. The fact that Trump's lawyers and Manafort's lawyers had that JDA has two implications. Number one, that's gone now. If Manafort's lawyers were to transmit documents to the president's lawyers, that would absolutely violate the terms of the cooperation agreement, if Mueller thinks that it would. And Mueller would obviously think that it would. Mm-hmm. And number two, remember what we've said, right? Like, this is a president who seems to believe that when you stick Michael Cohen's name on something, it becomes privilege. And that is not the case. So, you know, this goes back to what you said. There may not, I get it that Donald Trump may not, you know, email or commit things to writing or whatever, but there may be emails, letters from Rudy Giuliani to Manafort's lawyers. I wouldn't exclude that possibility. And they may be something that ultimately Mueller says, yeah, that's not privilege. You're going to have to turn that over. So, you know, that's super speculative. I want to underline that with all of it, but I want us to understand the legal facts that give rise to that speculation.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Let's get to our really good listener question here from Peter Graham. I heard on the news that Paul Manafort lost ownership to a number of residences, including a Trump Tower apartment, when he pled guilty. If Trump gives him a pardon, does he get that property back? That's a really interesting question.
Yeah, I thought that was a great question. He's absolutely correct. In paragraph 12, that's on pages 10 to 11 of the agreement, Manafort agrees to surrender 9 different properties as part of criminal forfeiture. And those are proceeds of the crimes to which he has pled guilty, right? I thought it was going to be a totally straightforward question of, if he gets pardoned by Trump, does he get the property back? And I thought the answer was going to be obviously not. The answer is probably not. And the reason is, and these are a bunch of 19th century cases, beginning with a case called Ex Parte Garland from 1866. That case stands for the proposition that the pardon not only merely releases the offender from the punishment prescribed in the offense, but it, quote, obliterates the legal contemplation of the offense itself, right? In other words, wipes it out from history. And relying on and subsequent to that case is a case called Osborne v. United States from 1875, which ordered the return of confiscated property that belonged to a petitioner who had received a full pardon from the president for aiding and abetting the Confederacy during the Civil War. And I would have never thought that a court could order, you know, obviously it was treason to aid the Confederacy. And I would have never thought that the Supreme Court would order the return of property to somebody who was pardoned for treason for, you know, aiding the enemy during wartime. But they did. And so the rule that has arisen out of these cases, and again, the most recent ruling that I can find is from 1877. And boy, reading 1877 cases is super fun. It's a case called Knott versus United States. And essentially what it says is if you have property that has been seized as a result of your criminal activity, and then you're pardoned for the criminal activity, and the property has not been disposed of, then it gets returned to you. Right. Huh. So the Osborne case, right, like the property was just kind of hanging out and they could give it back. And the court was like, OK, well, then give it back. The way in which Manafort's plea deal is written describes in detail that the criminal forfeiture immediately is transferred to the United States government, that the consent to the forfeiture is final and irrevocable as to his interests in the forfeited assets. It says your client understands that the United States may institute civil or administrative forfeiture proceedings against all forfeitable property in which your client has an interest, including those nine houses that we talked about, without regard to his status of his criminal conviction. I've never seen that in a plea deal before. Maybe maybe it is, but I haven't seen that in a plea deal before. I think that is an effort to say we are complying with the language in Knott versus United States. And that as of the moment you signed this, those properties have been transferred over to the U.S. Treasury. You have disclaimed any and all interest in them. And so if you get pardoned in the future, quote, without regard to the status of your criminal conviction, end quote, you don't get them back. So I think they've made it as irrevocable as possible. But
that's really interesting. So if you were a drug dealer and you got charged, well, I don't know, whatever, a federal crime. No, I guess it doesn't have to be. Hypothetically, you're a drug dealer, you're charged with a crime, and then either the governor or the president or whoever it would be pardons you. It's not like they're like, okay, here's your drugs back.
You do not get to say, hey, do I get my drugs back?
Why is that different? Because again, I don't understand.
Well, it's different because rich white criminal defendant owning property versus poor criminal defendant owning
illegal
drugs.
He still gained all this property through totally illegal methods.
Absolutely right. I think it would be a super interesting case. I don't want to bet on the kid coming out ahead. If you were, let's follow out the hypothetical. Suppose you're in a state, as you are in California, in which the recreational possession of marijuana is considered legal. You are then prosecuted federally for, let's say, transporting that marijuana across state lines. You, went to Oregon with it in your car and drove back, right? And marijuana is illegal as a controlled Schedule I controlled substance under the federal law, but legal as an asset under California state law. It would be a super interesting question if it has not otherwise been, assigned to the government or forfeited, whether you would get it back. I kind of want to contact somebody who does, street crime cases and say, hey, you should.
Yeah, but how often do they ever get a pardon?
Yeah, I don't know, but but it's a standard thing, right? Like we've got, it's on the whiteboard to talk about civil and criminal forfeiture. Drug cases are very often these days about seizing huge swaths of property.
Yeah.
It's a massive problem. And I would love to see a case of, hey, you got to give me my weed back. I think there's a non-trivial argument for if it's legal and it hasn't been disposed of, then, you know, if you gave the Confederate officer back his, you know, ill-gotten property from committing treason, yeah, you should probably give the kid back his bag of weed. But I don't know of any cases that that have so held.
We always come up with better premises for log movies and shows than there are out there. That'd be funny.
Oh, gosh.
It'd be a good I would dark watch comedy the hell out or something. Of that movie. Yeah.
This week's episode is brought to you by Beachbody On Demand. Beachbody On Demand is an online portal. You get instant access to their streaming service that gives a wide variety of effective workouts that you can do from the comfort of your own home. Here's how it works. You log in. I do it on my phone. You can then select your difficulty level, the amount of time you have for the workout, what you want to do with that workout, right? Slimming, building your core, building muscle, whatever, and then it filters out and you can choose from among the programs. So I've been doing the 10-minute trainer with Tony Horton. I've been doing that because obviously I'm incredibly busy all the time, but you can make 10 minutes a day to work out, and I've been really happy with the program, really happy with the results. So if you've been thinking about losing weight, maybe try it out with me. And as of right now, listeners to Opening Arguments can get a free trial membership. All you have to do is text OA to 303030. So text OA to 303030. You get free access to the entire platform, all of the workouts, the nutrition information. There are cooking guides. There's support. There's online community. There are like a million people online that all participate in the online community. And you can access all of their workout materials and give it a try. So send out text OA to 303030 and try Beachbody On Demand.
All right. Well, we have a lot to get to with Kavanaugh. We're running behind. So we'll have to catch up here and talk about Kavanaugh.
Thank you, Dr. Hibbert. I rest my case. Case closed.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
The cool thing about Kavanaugh's name is it's when you say it, it sounds similar to one of Andrew's coughing fits that I'm hoping Brian has edited out. Kavanaugh! Yeah. So we can't tell if you're...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not the only thing leaving a bad taste in my mouth this week. I want to start this way. You just did a fantastic episode of SIO. It's episode 158. I'm going to link it in the show notes. It discusses the underlying merits of the allegations. And I want to direct everybody there to that show to listen to that discussion, because we're going to talk here about the legal and political implications. And I have to tell you, like, I feel a little icky about that, right? Like there is a larger social issue. It's not the purpose of the show, but yeah, like I feel a little icky about talking about it, but you know, that's what we've got to do. The hearing has been adjourned until Monday. So the Senate Judiciary Committee will reconvene its hearings on Monday, and we will learn more about Dr. Ford's allegations. As of right now, she's called for an investigation, but does not plan to testify. The interesting thing about her story is that it involves a third person. And so, unlike other situations, there is the potential for corroboration, which is super
rare. Let me run
this
by you. Something I talked about in SIO, in all of this, is it's a reason why, another on the long list of reasons why I think her story is true and it's very credible. She named, you know, the person she named wasn't her friend or nobody that's in the room. The person she put in the room, because he was in the room, was Kavanaugh's friend, who very easily could just say, oh, no, didn't happen. So that lends it more credibility, in my opinion. But anyway, I want to ask you about this. It's curious. The Republicans want her to testify. And my theory is and let me know what you think about this, that they just want to do, I think they've learned a little bit of a lesson from Anita Hill. Like, they don't want to come off as, like, they've learned, like, a tiny bit of a lesson. They're like, okay, we're not going to be mean to Dr. Ford. Like, we're not going to do that part. But what my theory is that they just want to put her on the stand, let her tell her story, then put Kavanaugh on, have him say, nah, and then they're like, well, okay, sounds like there's nothing, can't trust, or whatever, or, you know, and then just confirm him anyway. And I think she doesn't want to do that, so she's saying, do an investigation. But what's interesting about that is Mark Judge, the friend who was in the room, doesn't want to go on the stand. And there's, I wanted to ask you this question, because people are speculating on the fact that, you know, Lindsey Graham is like, oh, we don't need to hear it. He's already said what he's going to say. And why doesn't that apply to Dr. Ford? And furthermore, they could just, what, subpoena him or whatever and make him testify, and that would be really easy. But the idea is, if he doesn't want to and they don't want to make him, that they kind of know that he's full of crap. But what do you think about all those theories?
I think I agree with you 100% on all of them, right? So, and the way I would maybe modify that a little bit is, I hope we're in a different environment now than in the early 1990s with respect to claims of sexual harassment.
I think some of us are. If you go on Fox News, they are not. I can't help it. In my episode, I talked about Laura Ingraham. God, she referred to the Anita Hill hearing as like asking Anita Hill the tough questions. That's what she referred to it as. Asking her the tough questions.
Yeah. And look, like, I mean, Anita Hill was smeared. And if I were counsel to Dr. Ford, right, you only have that precedent to go by. And so I'm not at all surprised. And let's get the Laura Ingraham false equivalence out of the way right now. The law has long recognized that victims of sexual assault, alleged victims of sexual assault, if you want to give a maximum credence to the other side, that they are to be treated differently than other witnesses. And so the idea that Kavanaugh's friend doesn't want to testify, and again, absolutely correct, these folks could be subpoenaed pursuant to the Senate's inherent power in the course of these proceedings. The idea that is just, that's a false equivalency. And I certainly read it the way you do, which is to say, you know, look, there's a lot of ways if you're the friend, right, you can say, you know, you could issue a denial. You could issue a, I don't fully remember it that way. You could issue a, I don't have a great recollection of what happened 36 years ago. We were drunk, and so I don't remember anything from that night. Like, there's a huge swath of potential possibilities, and I don't want to talk about it. I think he's still on paper of having
denied that it happened, but he's unwilling to go on record and say that, which I find interesting, under oath or whatever.
Right, anyway. Because that would obviously open him up to charges of perjury, yeah, if he lies. Okay, so let's talk about the things to look for, again, from a legal and political perspective. And I want to emphasize the way in which we got here is a little bit of what Yodel Mountain is supposed to be all about, right? Jeff Flake, Republican from Arizona, said, I'm not comfortable with voting on Kavanaugh until we've had an opportunity to vet these allegations. And that's what Yodel Mountain is all about. It is finding folks on the other side of the aisle who say, yeah, I look, I'm totally on board. And again, like, you know, let's not rush off to declare Jeff Flake, a profile in courage or anything. You know, he voted for the tax bill. You know, he has done very little to block Trump other than, you know, occasionally coming forward with some rhetoric. But and his seat is I think it's now a 2-to-1 chance that it's going to go to Kyrsten Sinema and flip from Republican to Democrat. So, you know, so he's doing us some favors in that sense. But yeah, like, this is This is part of what long-term change in the political system is about. I've been a notorious optimist throughout this process. And I'm going to link, this is a 538 aggregation of the polls, but that the polls show a definitive move in the direction towards approval of Mueller, approval of the Mueller investigation, disapproval of Trump, the notion that the investigation is not partisan, not unfair. And this is not, it's not specific to Kavanaugh. I haven't seen any polling on the Kavanaugh hearings, but it's analogous, right? Like Jeff Flake said, either, and he's retiring, so either politically in terms of his potential, because he's going to retire and go into lobbying. That's what retired senators who are not 200 do. Either in terms of, on a crass level, maintaining my relationship with my contacts and my integrity, or on a personal level, right? Like, let's not, you know, it's easy to sort of demonize the Republicans as all being, you know, lockstep in line behind Trump because they're, you know, cartoon villains, but only like Donald Trump and Paul Manafort and his inner circle are cartoon villains, right? Like, everybody else are just ordinary villain.
Yeah, sure. They might be the only cartoon villains, but all the other Republicans are the Christopher Lloyd starring with doing more villainy with the cartoons. So that's I don't know about that. I feel like they vote with Trump quite a bit.
That is an A+ Who Framed Roger Rabbit reference. Today's episode is sponsored by Indochino. And let me tell you, I am really, really excited about this sponsor. You guys know I have to wear suits into court. And I will tell you, right, when I used to work for certain large firms that need not be named, I did the whole like tailor thing. And that's really, really expensive to have custom made suits until now. I honestly super excited about this deal. If you need a suit, you should take advantage of the opening arguments offer. So let me tell you, what is Indochino? They are online site. They are the world's largest made-to-measure menswear company. And what they do is they make custom tailored suits that are designed to fit your body better than a generic off-the-rack suit. I used Indochino. I ordered a custom shirt. Our listeners know that I have lost some weight, so a lot of my shirts really, particularly my dress shirts, really don't fit well. And I'm kind of tough to fit. And it's super easy, right? What you do is you go on to Indochino.com. If you're ordering a suit, you pick the fabric. You choose your customizations. This is super cool, right? Like, you can choose like really tiny details down to, you know, lapel width, the kind of lining you want on the inside, whether you want it monogrammed, all of the kind of cool stuff that you get when you get a made-to-order suit. You submit to your measurements, and then your custom suit arrives in the mail. It is really, really cool. So the tremendous selection, high quality fabrics. Like I said, you can personalize the details down to a really, really tiny level. Here's what you have to do. You can get any premium Indochino suit for $379 at Indochino.com. What you have to do is enter the promo code OA at checkout. That is 50% off regular price. $379 is super cheap for a men's suit. It's cheap for an off-the-rack suit. For a custom-made suit, I mean, it's, I don't know how they can do it. Shipping is free, right? So that's a final cost to you. That is Indochino.com, promo code OA. You get any premium suit for $379 and free shipping. That is an incredible deal for a suit that will fit you better than anything off the rack ever could. Indochino.com, promo code OA. So, you know, we talk about a lot of depressing stuff on the show. You know, I want to say this is part of the slow shift in the culture that, you know, it was not Lisa Murkowski. It was not Susan Collins. It was Jeff Flake who came forward and said, let's stop this, you know, runaway train to confirm Kavanaugh at breakneck pace. And that should give you some hope. That dovetails into the stupidest thing that I have seen about Dr. Ford's Ooh. Allegations and the Kavanaugh hearings.
I think I could one up you on this, but
okay.
I saw some stupid stuff.
Let's see.
Okay, here we go. Drum roll.
I offer forward this one.
Yeah.
That is Eric Erickson, and I cannot believe I live in a universe in which we have to take Eric Erickson seriously on this show. Eric Erickson's, you know, if they don't confirm Kavanaugh immediately, this will just open the floodgates to last minute allegations against every future Supreme Court nominee. Yeah. And what a disgusting thing to say. Like, you think maybe if we nominated a few more women to the Supreme Court, that just like statistically likely there would be less of that. But also, right, this process is on is expedited on a level that is unprecedented in American history, right? It is crucial, we've talked about this, for Mitch McConnell to ram through the Kavanaugh appointment, hopefully prior to the midterms. If they have to wait and do it in the lame duck session, I believe that they will.
Oh, of course they will.
But like, look, that is... you know, potential. There are Republican senators who are going to be up in 2020. And if participating in, again, they may want to hijack the Senate seat. I am sure they do. They may not want to lose re-election more than they want to help Trump hijack a Senate seat. So,
do you mean hijack a justice? You said Senate.
Yeah, sorry.
Twice.
Cough medicine. All right. So, look. I believe every Republican, including Jeff Flake, wants a conservative justice on the Supreme Court, and they want to aid and abet Donald Trump. They've already been on the McConnell plan for Merrick Garland and Neil Gorsuch, right? So again, we're not talking about profiles in courage. But if confirming a Supreme Court justice after, especially one as potentially flawed as Kavanaugh is looking, after the midterms, and after Democrats have retaken the Senate, if they've retaken the Senate, that could put you in danger of losing re-election in 2020. And there may be Republicans who value not losing re-election more than they value instituting the permanent rightward shift of the Supreme Court for the next 30 years. They may care more about themselves than they do about their ideology.
I don't know. I think
that. And boy, I hope so, right? Like, that's right. That's what we're banking on right now. We're banking on the self-interest of Republican members of the Senate.
Don't you think they can just do the Jeff Flake thing and just like ruin the court for 100 years and then ride off into the $1 billion sunset of, you know, lobbying? I feel like that's what they'll do.
Yep,
I don't know. I have no faith in that.
Look, I don't. I want to be clear as we're talking about this. The overwhelming likelihood remains that Kavanaugh is approved and becomes the narrowest Supreme Court nominee in American history. Right. That he gets onto the Supreme Court 50-49 or 51-49. I think that's the most likely outcome. But I will say part of what is going on right now. I'm going to say this, and again, this is
I
ugly.
Just want to note, though, you think that's more likely than they just rescind his nomination real quick and do somebody else?
Yeah, and part of that, there are a couple of things with respect to that, right? Number one is Donald Trump, right?
Yeah.
He is not somebody who
stubborn.
Likes to, you know, suffer defeat. Number two has to do with scheduling, right? Because remember that all of the Republican senators who are up this cycle, and not a lot of them, but they face tough re-election fights. And so you can schedule more days in the Senate, but the reason why Senate has a recess is to let members of the Senate
right.
go home and campaign. And so if you're keeping the Senate in operation, you know, you're interfering with the ability of the vulnerable Republicans who are running for re-election being back at home with their constituents. There's a real cost there. Again, yeah. You know, I don't want to say. So, yeah, if you pulled the plug on Kavanaugh, nominated a new person tomorrow, started the whole process over, you know, I guess you could find somebody with no record.
Yeah, just nominate, you know, like a child or something, just somebody with a blank, whatever.
You know, look, like you could get Hardiman from the Third Circuit, right? That was someone who has a lengthy record, solid credentials, and, you know, will probably be able to move expeditiously. But I don't think they're going to do
this
that.
Is interesting. OK, couple miscellaneous things, because yeah. I was just so it blew my mind. I listened to the 538 podcast, and one of the first ones they did on this, I can't remember what it was, but all three of the people on the show were like, well, yeah, this definitely is it for Kavanaugh. They're going to rescind and do another thing. And I was like, what Trump have you been watching for this whole time? I mean, it's possible, but it was weird that all three of them just agree, just matter of factly. And I thought it was so weird. What a weird thing. I I'm just so cynical from this Trump era, but I found that hard to believe. And then the other thing I was going to say is, I think it's really interesting. I thought McConnell was kind of BSing when he had that quote about how I think Kavanaugh will be the tough one to get through. We probably shouldn't do that. I thought he was kind of just being McConnell and just saying whatever, you know, for some weird nefarious purpose. But actually, maybe he was just having a rare moment of telling the truth and saying that Kavanaugh would be the hardest one to get through because of all this paperwork and all this stuff. So that's interesting. I think what do you think about that? I think he actually was just telling the truth in that instance, it seems like.
Yeah, another Kinsley gaffe, right? Like accidentally told the truth there.
he probably went home and like flogged himself after that. Ah, damn it. I said something true. I'll never forgive myself.
Thanks. That'll replace the whale in my nightmares now. All right. Two more things on Kavanaugh. As an overview, I want to say, and I realized this is ugly coming out of my mouth, I think the biggest chance to get someone to change their mind on Kavanaugh on the other side of the aisle will come not from Dr. Ford's allegations per se, but will come from the perception that this person has not been truthful again and again before the Senate Judiciary Committee. I'm not saying that's how I want it to be, but I'm saying that given prior nominee precedent, given the prior behavior of Republican senators, I don't think that just Dr. Ford's allegations are going to move the needle, even with Lisa Murkowski, even with Susan Collins by themselves. I think the, 36 years ago, but
they'll be able to downplay I think you're probably right.
But I think if there's a notion that this guy has just played fast and loose and hasn't been truthful, I think there's some potential that moves the needle. So with that in mind, there are two more things I want to hit really quickly. I know we're going long. The first is that there is a FOIA lawsuit pending. It was filed by the six Democratic members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. So Blumenthal, Leahy, Sheldon Whitehouse, Mazie Hirono, Cory Booker, and my new girlfriend, Kamala Harris.
Right? Yeah.
They have alleged that they've filed FOIA requests with both the National Archives and the CIA for Kavanaugh-related documents. And the National Archives hasn't responded, and the CIA just gave them a tracking number. And obviously, those executive agencies, this is a real problem in FOIA requests generally. You know, the agency can take a long time and then say, you know, to independent journalists, bloggers, people like that, oh yeah, we'll grant your FOIA request, but you know, it's that document is 116,000 pages and you have to pay us, you know, 50 cents a page or whatever to produce it. Because the government, part of the FOIA Act is they can charge back the costs on to citizens who make those requests. They have to be able to do that, right? Otherwise, the Larry Klamans of the world would just bankrupt, you know, Democratic administrations and be like, I demand a copy of every document that Obama's ever seen, you know, whatever. But yeah, so they got no answer and now they have filed a lawsuit. I will upload it. The status conference on the lawsuit and request for temporary injunction that would grant them access to the National Archives to get those documents. Of course, that status hearing is tomorrow because we record today. I want to say that I want to dampen enthusiasm a lot, right? Like, people bring these kinds of lawsuits all the time, and almost always the courts defer to the executive agencies who will come in and go, look, this is a broad request and it's going to take us some time and we're busy on X, Y, and Z. And so we're going to get there, but don't issue an injunction. And most of the time they don't. Time is really of the essence here. So I don't, it's a meritorious, non-frivolous argument. I would guess that if I had to guess, I would guess against the granting of an injunction, but I'm not, it could happen. So keep an eye on that. And then the final thing that I want to put on the radar is it's a letter written by a California lawyer and his name is Cyrus Sinai. He has a longstanding feud with Alex Kaczynski, and I'm going to discuss Kaczynski in a minute. So Kaczynski opened an ethics investigation against Mr. Sinai. You know, take that as you will. This is a person who has been disciplined, who has an open ethics investigation. So to the extent that undermines your credibility, it is what it is. He wrote a letter to Dianne Feinstein and Chuck Grassley and CC'd the other members of the Senate Judiciary Committee asking that they produce records and open an investigation into the relationship between Brett Kavanaugh and Judge Alex Kaczynski of the Ninth Circuit. And let me explain why that is for a minute and how this relates to the Dr. Ford allegations. Alex Kaczynski was an incredibly well-respected judge on the Ninth Circuit. He is somebody who, from a jurisprudential standpoint, I could get behind as a non-originalist conservative potential Supreme Court nominee. And indeed, he was long thought of as a potential nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court until when he was elevated to the Ninth Circuit. It came out that he, while at the Office of Special Counsel, had improperly counseled Ronald Reagan's Secretary of the Interior, James Watt, who once had summarized his views of the role of the Secretary of the Interior as under Ronald Reagan as, we're going to drill more, we're going to mine more, and we're going to cut more timber. So there was a whistleblower named Jack Spadaro, that whistleblower was fired, and the evidence is overwhelming that Kaczynski helped James Watt figure out how to fire a whistleblower, a guy who is one of the top mine safety experts in the country, how to fire him without violating the law that prevents you from firing whistleblowers, right? So when that came up during his Ninth Circuit hearings, Kaczynski, there were 43 senators that voted against Kaczynski to the Ninth Circuit. He was confirmed, but that pretty much killed his chances of being on the Supreme Court. That being said, as I alluded to in the beginning, Kaczynski is one of the most respected intellectual jurists on the Supreme Court and was known as a feeder judge, right? His clerks, very often, he was a former Anthony Kennedy clerk, and his clerks often went on to clerk for Anthony Kennedy. And let me say, because this is really crucial to the understanding the entire relationship, that's by and large the way in which Supreme Court justices pick their clerks, right? Because everybody wants to clerk for the Supreme Court. I wanted to clerk for the Supreme Court, right?
I'll do it if they're looking for somebody, sure.
Yeah, exactly, right? So the fact that you graduated with honors from Harvard doesn't do anything, right? Like that, everybody at Harvard in that class wants to clerk for the Supreme Court, and everybody who petitioned last year, but didn't make it, but got a call back, we'll try again. And so what Supreme Court justices do is they call their former clerks and they say, hey, do you have somebody who is really, really good? Because, you know, I mean, you know what this job takes. You have somebody who's really, really good. And that is the way that you get on to the Supreme Court, by and large. There are exceptions. There are people who are just so unbelievably talented that they go straight to the Supreme Court, including a classmate and friend of mine who's now a federal judge, obviously smarter than me. So Kaczynski was somebody Kennedy went to for recommendations for his Supreme Court clerks. And Kaczynski knew this, right? So, for example, he once put out a job description saying, I'm looking for amazingly intelligent Supreme Court clerk wannabes eager to slave like dogs for an unreasonably demanding boss. Right now, that right. Nothing wrong with that. Lots of judges are and lots of judges are kind of self-described assholes. Kaczynski did was incorporated that work foolishness into his personal proclivities. And so, the allegations, there were more than 15 women that came forward to testify that Kaczynski engaged in conduct that the bulk of which I would say would be described as creating a hostile work environment for female clerks, right? Allegations that he would show pornography in judges' chambers, that he would forward along inappropriate emails, that he made inappropriate comments. Dahlia Lithwick, who writes for Slate, a tremendous writer, has put in print that when she was talking to Judge Kaczynski and he learned that she was in town, he asked her, hey, what are you wearing? So again, nothing. I want to be. And there are things like, you know, moving a name tag out of the way where you brush a woman's breast and I mean, like creep behavior, right? Things that in my view, right? Nothing that arises to the level of assault or anything like that. But things that would state a plausible claim for hostile work environment, right?
I would think so.
Yeah. And I wanted, it's why I explained the feeder system first, because the relationship between a boss and a subordinate is a tough relationship anyway, right? The relationship between Alex Kaczynski holding my recommendation is your key to clerking for the Supreme Court in my hands is an inducement at a level that I can't even imagine. Right. I guess I can imagine it. Right. Like I know what it is like to be a go-getter and a gunner and to literally do anything. And I can. This is the part where, you know, I have to try and put myself in someone's shoes. I can only imagine a 25-year-old woman clerking for Kaczynski and saying, all right, like this guy is a pervert and a horn dog and he makes inappropriate comments and he watches porn at work. Are you kidding me? All I have to do is suck this up for a year and then I can clerk for the Supreme Court and I'm willing to suck that up. And that's what hostile work environment is meant to prevent, right? Like that's the entire reason we have those laws in the first place. So, you know, I don't know. There was never a trial. There was never anything. After 15 women came forward, Kaczynski stepped down in December of 2017 from the Ninth Circuit. I should add, you know, and again, in this situation, he will almost certainly be replaced with somebody worse, right? Like he will be from a jurisprudential standpoint, you know, but that is what that is. How does this tie into Brett Kavanaugh? It ties into Brett Kavanaugh because Brett Kavanaugh was asked about clerking for Kaczynski, and he said he never saw any evidence that Kaczynski behaved inappropriately in chambers towards any of his clerks. And Cyrus Sinai's letter says, and I just want to read the sentence, he is either lying or so willfully blind to judicial misconduct that he should not be appointed. And that's where I think it feeds into that kind of general that general approach. Because again, there's an answer that Kavanaugh could have given, assuming that the allegations are correct. There's an answer that he could have given that is appropriate, right? Which is, I was 26 years old, and this was a prominent judge, and I was a go-getter, and I wanted to clerk for Justice Kennedy, and absolutely would I. There was no chance that the judge's word was law in chambers, and right. So no, I didn't do anything, and no, I never said anything, and in hindsight, I wish I had, right?
Right.
I could have said that. And that would have been, when we were talking about the Kavanaugh hearings, I would have called that out as a good and a fair answer. That wasn't said. So that kind of pulls everything that we might want to look for when the hearings resume again on Monday.
All right. Well, that's it for Kavanaugh. Again, check it. I didn't submit my stupidest thing anybody said, because you can find it in Serious Inquiries Only 158. I talk about Franklin Graham and what he said. So check it out there. But
That is so not fair as a Trump card.
Hey, you said stupidest thing anyone said. There's no rule that says a dog can't play basketball. Okay, so there you have it. And it is time to thank our top patrons.
Yeah, thank you to Registry Matters, Zach Fisher, Make Cybertron Prime Again. I agree. Here for the Yodeling, Fettuccine Alfredo. I like that. Nemo Judex in Sua Causa. And it's well established. I don't know Latin, so I have no idea what I just said. Rebecca Brennis, HOTUS and the Taint Team 2020. Brian Studwell, Support Trump Campaign Gymnastics. Everybody's flipping. Ryan Null, Blank Boxman, LiveBaseballScorecards.com. Oh, check that out. Kurt Robinson, Kiwa Valley Exports for Australian Red Meat and Craft Beer. Check that out, too. That sounds delicious. Don't pardon me. I'll pardon myself. Poseidon is 9/10 of maritime law. I know we encourage our listeners to change it every week, but that one makes me laugh every single time. Claire Darbois is easier to pronounce than Kwisatz Haderach. I agree. Healing Elementals on Etsy. Promo code OpenArgs for 10% off. Sam, Milo Meadsong, the Halfling Bard, and SIU 3L, the other Michael Cohen. I hope we're getting a monopoly on Michael Cohens in our patronage. The Getting Off Podcast, Join Your Labor Union, Together We Bargain, Alone We Beg. Help, help, I'm trapped in a username factory. Make criminal law like hockey law, no trial, 2 minutes in a box. Starry Decisis from the top rope, brother.
Wow, nice.
David Satz, Mike the Intactivist, James Call is spending a year dead for tax reasons, Rob Schreck, Brian Upshaw's Last Chance for Profit Prison, Dalen Lee Samus Grix, Buttercup's Polyphony Services, Actual Yodeling Advice from an Actual Cat, Japan Dan, Legalize Awoo, Anonymous, No, It Is Dr. Bergerius, Eric Carlson's New Golf Clubs, oh, congrats, Eric, I Turn Myself Into a Pickle, I'm Pickle Rick. Okay. They call him Flipper, faster than lightning. Still celebrating the engagement. Okay, well now, like, we were on board, but this has been like 5 or 6 weeks. I think we need to move on to another. We're happy. We're excited, but I think we need to move on, right? Squint Finger, that's a new one. Jeremiah unironically said kids these days today and is now old. Oh gosh. I just got back from a debate tournament. I said that like a half dozen times. I'll double my pledge if you stop FF references. I don't know what FF is. I don't know. We'd love for you to double your pledge. You're going to have to tell us what that is. Unnamed senior administration official. God, I would give anything for that to be a real unnamed senior administration official.
And this week in news with Kevin and Benedict, a sail away with Yodel Mountain Distillery, Dread Kavanaugh Dark Rum, a rabid anti-dentite. Guy Chapman has built more walls than Donald Trump. Keith Davies, wordorigins.org, your guide to legal terms from 13th century Saxony. Using my wife's Patreon to make Andrew say things since episode 186. The Cobra Kavanaugh. The Cobra Kavanaugh. That's funny. Seriously, I will pay $30 for a cool Yodel Mountain t-shirt. Soul, there's so much pressure on Wednesday nights to come up with something. Liz, Metaphysical Certitude Weeks. Big Easy Blasphemy. A String of Unpronounceable Characters. The TTTBE Co-Ed Cheer Squad. Less sexy but enthusiastic as hell. Legalize the Purge. Emily, I accept your challenge for Andrew. Eric Brewer, pick a side. Jordan B. Peters' son, not Jordan B. Peters' son. I couldn't come up with anything clever this week. Rhonda the Rigged Witch Hunter. Malika Chandler. Hotspots on my dog. Soggy Pants. CampQuest.org, CampQuest.org, CampQuest.org. Sam Danow. Dave, living life Yodel Mountain High in Trump's America. President Donald J. Yeti Pubes. I cannot think of anything new this week. Man, lots of those this week. Adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking. Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense. Aaron Grady, Matthew Vernon, the week that ruined Mario Kart forever. There it is. Ian and Ali, St. Muller, patron saint of yodelers. Sakashite Fukasumi, Jim Grove, Eli Bosnick, Cooking Heath with Ramen, Mitchell, and Interrupting Thomas Says What? Nooners, Spooners, and Hot Air Ballooners, LLP. Open Args, serving up Mullard wine and cheese since 2016. Mormon J. Fox, Everybody is Gonna Die, Come Watch TV. And finally, Conrad Michaels, champion of all Patreons right now. Thank you guys so much. That's patreon.com/law if you'd like to join their ranks.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it is time for TTTBE Crucial. Every question is crucial now. How many do I have to get right, essentially, in a row? Or I have one more to give.
Yeah, you have one more to give. This is the push to the playoffs here.
Oh, yeah.
All right. And you have a constitutional law question. So
not my specialty, but
there you go. No, not real property. You have not real property law question.
Constitution.
All right. Congress passed a statute directing the United States Forest Service, a federal agency, to issue regulations to control campfires on federal public lands and to establish a schedule of penalties for those who violate the new regulations. Hmm. The statute provides that the Forest Service regulation should, quote, reduce to the maximum extent feasible all potential hazards that arise from campfires on Forest Service lands. The Forest Service issued the regulations and the schedule of penalties directed by Congress. The regulations include a rule that provides for the doubling of the fine for any negligent or prohibited use of fire if the user is under the influence of alcohol or drugs. Which of the following arguments best supports a finding that the rule providing for the fines is constitutional? A. The executive branch of government, of which the Forest Service is a part, has inherent rulemaking authority over public lands. B. The rule was issued pursuant to a valid exercise of Congress's power to delegate rulemaking authority to federal agencies. C. The rule is justified by a compelling government interest in safeguarding forest resources. Or D. The rule relates directly to law enforcement, which is an executive rather than a legislative function, and hence it does not need specific congressional authorization.
Oh, man, this is really hard. I think it's really hard anyway. Okay, I'm looking for eliminations. I got one that's my favorite. I think one I could eliminate would be... I'm wondering what... Now I'm confused as to what the... Because it just says, which of the following supports the finding that the rule is constitutional... It doesn't really say which aspect we're evaluating. Like, is the fact that they can charge a fine at all constitutional, or the fact that Congress has delegated this authority to the Forest Service, is that constitutional? It doesn't say. Because, like, okay, A, the executive branch of government, of which the Forest Service is a part, has inherent rulemaking authority over public lands. I don't know about that, because if that were true, then Congress didn't even need to pass a law giving them the authority to do this. I don't know about A. I'm leaning toward B, the rule was issued pursuant to a valid exercise of Congress's power to delegate rulemaking authority to federal agencies. That seems right to me. B is the one I'm going for. C, the rule is justified by a compelling government interest in safeguarding forest resources. So if C could be true if we're not really talking about the delegation, but rather just the fact that they're issuing fines at all. Like, that's the justification for it. But I don't know. It depends on which issue we're looking at, but I'm not leaning towards C right now. D, the rule relates directly to law enforcement, which is an executive rather than legislative function, and hence it does not need specific congressional authorization. That seems wrong to me. So D feels the most wrong. Followed by C and A. I'm going to go with B. I'm not 100% sure on this one. This was a confusing one, but B is what's really leaning, what I'm leaning toward. I think it's pretty straightforward and hopefully it's right. So I'm going with B. Wow. I don't know. This is nerve-wracking. I only have one more to give, but B's my final answer.
All right. And if you'd like to play along with Thomas, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media. Use the hashtag TTTBE. Include your answer, your reasons therefore. And we will pick a winner and shower that winner with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune, not guaranteed.
All right. Well, that's our show. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks most of all to our patrons for making the show happen. Go get that bonus stuff and go get Lot off of movies. All that good stuff at patreon.com/law. And thanks to Andrew for toughing it through his plague that he caught. And get well soon, Andrew. And we'll see you guys next episode.
You betray the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.